Hi there, my name's Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. And I hope you're going to like it. I'm going to be in conversation with well-known, interesting figures. Now, when it gets to the end of that conversation, don't rush off, because we have got the illustrious, wondrous psychologist Karen Cowan on hand to discuss what's been said and to give us some insight and various tips on what we can do with our mental health. It's all going to be great. Enjoy. Welcome to Shed Talks, episode 13. Our next guest, when warned that he might be asked some really personal, possibly intrusive questions during his Shed Talk encounter, responded, "Bring it on." At my age, he said, things like that don't tend to worry me too much. So we're extremely fortunate, chuffed and lucky, and what can we say, to welcome our very first member of the House of Lords and unbelievably our eldest guest ever on this show. A huge welcome to Lord Clive Brooke of Arbuthnot. Clive, welcome.
Hello, Jeremy.
Great to have you here. Really, really good. Let's kick off. We know that there is many things to talk about in terms of your spectacular career in trade unions and so forth, but I want to just get to the personal. You were born in 1942. You are 80 years old and the youngest 80 I've ever met. The son of John Brooke and Mary Colbeck. And you brought up in Wakefield in Yorkshire. And you had three elder brothers, Fred, Frank, and Jack.
Yes.
Was that a happy family? Was it good times? Do you remember?
I've got good times to remember, but there were some problems within the family, which were nicely hidden.
Oh.
I was a mistake. I was born in the middle of the war. My mother and father had three boys in 3 years, and then they went 12 years, and I popped out.
Wow. Right.
So I was almost an only child. And so I was a mistake in the first instance. My father told me I'd been the worst day's work he'd done. They'd had a weekend away when he came home from the war, and they'd been across to Blackpool, and I was conceived, I gather, in Lancashire, in Blackpool.
Right.
He once told me the worst day's work in his life. And that gives you a bit of an indication of the kind of relationship I had with my father.
Yes.
So I was a mistake. And the second thing is then when I popped out, I was not the girl he wanted, but I was another boy. And I think that was an influential factor in the nature of the relationship between the two of us. And also my relationship with nature, with life. I think I should have been a girl, and I in part had this desire as a child to be the girl my father wanted.
Really?
But of course, I was a boy. And
right. It,
I think, created the conflicts in me, which have been quite a factor in my early life and, well, in my later life too, which have led me on the route I followed.
Do you mean that in the sense that you were sort of sensitive child and interested in things that perhaps boys weren't interested in, or was it not that obvious?
Yes, it was a bit like that. My brother next to me was a very good sportsman. He was very bright. He played rugby union for Wakefield, for Yorkshire, and for the British Army. My father was a sportsman, a keen cricketer. And sports was about the last thing I was ever interested in. I was more on the arty side.
Yeah.
And in fact, I recollect I used to irritate him intensely by doing a little bit of semi-ballet dancing in front of him.
And oh, right, right.
Used to drive him up the wall.
That was pretty confrontational.
Yes. So there was that element to me, but of course I was a male, but with a strong feminine side.
Right. Interesting. Very interesting. What about your mum?
My mum, I was thinking about her this morning, interestingly. My mum was a driver, wanted to make achievements and progress for her children particularly. She'd had a poor relationship with her mother, but had been much loved by her father. And she had her father's traits. She was musical, intelligent, had the opportunity to go to a grammar school, but her parents wouldn't permit it. She was pushed into the mill.
Right.
And was a weaver from fairly early on. Interestingly, my mother was carrying me. She was working as a weaver. My father was away during the war. She was looking after the three boys. And she had an accident when she was walking to work early in the morning in the dark.
Right.
In a blackout. And apparently was laid on the floor and was found an hour or so later. And I've been told subsequently that that accident when I was in the womb possibly had quite a bearing on my nature too.
Right. Right.
Quite a lot of medical research on this about trauma.
Yeah, that's an interesting point to note. And what happened to your mum? Was she all right?
She was all right, and she was shaken, I think, for a couple of days, but then back to work. So she was a grafter. She was hardworking. She was intelligent. And she was keen for her children to do well, particularly educationally.
Were you a favourite?
I was very much the favourite. And and she told everybody I was the favourite.
Right.
Didn't help me in my relationship with my brothers.
Or your father.
Or my father. I think I tended to come between. I spent the first 2 years of my life sleeping with my mother because my father was away. And then I was kicked out of the bed when my father returned at the war's end. And I went to sleep with one of my brothers. And so it was a fallout with my father all the way down the line.
Very, very interesting. And I mean, you know, having three elder brothers, I mean, could either be a dream or it could be a nightmare.
Well, I mean,
is where you learned to become such a good negotiator.
Well, it was with my brother next to me, who was a very good sportsman and I wasn't. And he'd been the youngest, of course, until I came along. And I think they'd wanted him to be a girl with your photographs of him dressed as a girl. Can you believe it?
Wow.
And, but he was very much the male sportsman. And I was rather envious, I think, of the way he was seen and perceived by my father and the way he was so successful with the sports. And we didn't get along very well because he then saw I was very attached to my mother. And I think he was always a little bit jealous of that. So there was enmity between us for much of our lives. But we did make up later in life and became good friends.
Oh, good. Right. But, okay, so you went to Thornshouse School in Wakefield, grammar school. Was that easy-peasy Japanesey because you were naturally bright? You know, what was it like?
I was bright at infant school and at junior school. I was top of the class, passed the 11 plus, went to grammar school, and then discovered that my brain probably wasn't as big as some of those around. I wasn't the star that I had been earlier in educational terms, so I found that a little bit difficult to accept. I found a new role for myself. Firstly, I became my best friend, and he became my best man. He's still around in touch with me. An extraordinary bright chap, became a physicist, a nuclear physicist. I attached to him as my best friend. And I became a bit of a clown to try and get attention from other people. Always in trouble, being given detention and 100 lines to write for misbehaving. And it was all about, look at me, to try to make up for what I felt was my deficiency in intellectual terms, certainly compared with my friend John.
Gosh. So,
I started drinking quite early. I was in with a crowd of people and we used to drink from 11, 12. Drinking alcohol.
Oh, really? Right.
I was given, as I was a late child birth for my parents, they gave me a good deal of freedom. I think they felt they'd done all the work with the three boys, and I had a lot of opportunity to do different things, and some of which I shouldn't have been doing really at that age.
Right, Right. Well, I mean, this is interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, when we look at, I mean, we'll mix and match here. When we look at you being in the Lords and the things you've achieved are huge, you know, but you've been a trustee of the Institute for Public Policy Research, a trustee for Community Service Volunteers, a trustee of Action on Addiction, and most recently, a patron of Sugarwise. And I mean, we'll come back to that because I know how many questions you've asked and things that you've tabled in the Lords, and you are a very, very hardworking peer. But we know that you have got an interest in addiction. Take us back, because it seems to me you had a really spectacularly successful career in public service with trade unions, you know, being on the TUC, ending up on the TUC Executive Committee. But I mean, if you can, talk me through that. Were you just flat out as a young man in your 20s, you know, in the Inland Revenue Union, really going for it?
Well, as I said, I was wanting to be looked at.
Ah, right.
Drinking in my early teens, and I left school at 16, and I went into the civil service, got the clerical officer job, and the first day I joined the civil service, I became the union representative for the staff union that looked after the interests of the employees in the Inland Revenue Staff Federation, as you mentioned. I became the voluntary secretary on the first day. Because the guy who was holding the post was looking for somebody to replace him. He'd had it too long, he said. So I was in the trade union movement right from the beginning.
Yeah.
I found it much more interesting than the revenue work, collecting taxes.
Yes.
I got the opportunity to organise, to go to meetings. I then became the branch secretary for the region around Leeds. I then became a delegate going to conferences. And I started travelling to different union events. And, of course, I also had a lot of company there, mainly men. It had a majority of women in the union, but it was run mainly in those days by a majority of men. And, of course, they were all drinkers. We drank together. And a lot of the men used it as an opportunity to get away from home. They wanted to change the world and to improve conditions, but they also had an opportunity to get some freedom from their other responsibilities. And so I mixed a lot with people like that, and we drank.
And that was in your 20s?
That was in my teens. I then got a full-time job with the union in London when I was 21. I moved from Yorkshire down to London.
Right.
And became a full-time employee with the Inland Revenue Staff Federation. And that was everything I wanted. Everything I wanted. I got a chance to try to change the world, to change conditions, to change life around me, change my own life. And off I went. And I was also drinking.
And tell me about, you know, Lorna and the marriage, because I know that it started off so well in 1967. And what would you say about that?
Well, we're still married after 55 years.
It's amazing. Wow.
Yeah. One of the greatest achievements of my life is to stayed in a marriage when, in fact, all the evidence indicated it shouldn't have continued. And Lorna was very tolerant and loving with me. She liked to drink as well. So there was a commonality between us there, but she didn't have the problems I had with it. She managed it much better. Until later in life, she's had some difficulties in later life with it.
Right.
We traveled a lot. We had a fascinating life. Work took me all around the world, as well as working in the UK and negotiating in the UK. And Lorna often got the opportunity of traveling with me. I was not the best of husbands. With the drink and the drugs came the acting out and of course, little affairs on the side.
Yes, yes.
Which there were many of them in different ways.
Yes.
Men as well as women.
Yes. Oh, right. Okay. Well, that sort of that goes back to the beginning, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's very honest. And what seems extraordinary in your story is that you became, maybe at the expense of your marriage to Lorna, but you seem to become more and more successful. It's what it seems to me like it was anyway. And yet the drinking and stuff was getting more and more out of control. It's kind of weird.
Well, I mean, the amazing thing is that there are so many people who manage to continue functioning quite lengthy periods, notwithstanding the amount of drink and drugs that they take. They hang in there, and there is a side of them that produces something as well as the negativity. The downside that we experience when we become an addict. Addictive personality. And the addictive personality gave me the strength to keep pushing the work side. But then there's the negative side, which was pulling it down, pulling me in a different direction. And my health was going very much during, I had liver troubles. I had a whole range of things that interfered with my progress during my 30s. But in particular, I think mentally I was being worn down by it.
Yeah.
At the end of my 30s, I was really at the end of my tether.
Right.
The marriage was falling apart. We'd had counselling to try and keep us together. And I ended up with a psychiatrist who said, you realise, Clive, of course, you're not just got a drinking problem, but you're an alcoholic. I said, no, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm hanging on to my job and I'm managing reasonably well and think I'm going to be promoted, actually. Because we've got a crowd of people who recognise, they were all the same type of people, of course, who promoted.
And they thought you were a jolly good...
Exactly, a jolly good fellow.
And he's, no, I can imagine that. I mean, just as a diversion for a tiny second, we used to work in the music business, and we wanted a band to reform, who were called Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers. And, they had a sort of spectacularly dodgy past, these people. We found out that the bass player, who I won't name, was a heroin addict, working as a futures broker on Wall Street. I mean, it was extraordinary. And he said, oh, well, of course I can come and do the reunion, but you have to fly me first class and this and that. And he managed to, I mean, he could not believe that he was on selling pork belly futures on Wall Street.
These conflicts, the paradox of life.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating that people think of addicts and alcoholics and everything. It's always terribly black and white. They think, they're on the park bench with the can of super.
Yeah.
But actually, it's as you're describing very well. So you basically became sober before you entered the House of Lords.
Oh yes, I would never have got to the Lords.
Really?
Had I not achieved sobriety.
Right.
My journey to the Lords was entirely dependent on that first day of sobriety.
Right.
And, some guidance being given to me on that day not to pick up the drink as I'd been doing for much of my life. And then secondly, I was guided by others working with me in AA and by embracing the 12-step program with them. And that is entirely the reason why I find myself eventually in the House of Lords. Without that change, on my 40th birthday, 21st of June, I would never have made it. I would have gone in a quite different direction and probably been dead by 42 years of age.
Gosh, right. Okay. Yeah, I got it. I mean, so really, I know that, we don't have to sort of be celebrating achievements, but you were the General Secretary of the Public Services Tax and Commerce Union, and that was a post you held up until 98.
Yes,
so just if I ask the question, what would you say was the worst point in the alcoholism addiction, and what was the light at the end of the tunnel, if it's possible to say?
Well, I think the worst point was when I started having liver problems.
How did that manifest?
Well, I had hepatitis B, which was probably picked up from acting out, linked with a drink, and then the liver started deteriorating. And I was told if I continued on that route, the inevitable would happen. I'd get cirrhosis and I would have death. And I had little choice on it. That would have happened.
Yes.
I was told by the medics that at 40, I'd got another 2 years. I'd lose my marriage, I'd lose my job, I'd lose everything, and I'd lose my life at the end of it if I continued drinking the way I was. So I had to make a big choice in my life. A different direction came. I was on the knee, down at the bottom.
Yeah.
I bent my knee and I happily had a touch on the shoulder and I was picked up and I found the AA program, 12-step program, got recovery on a day-by-day basis. Just one day at a time, I managed to stay sober and fairly early, very good results. I did extraordinarily good work in my job, explored new areas, which took me into contact with politics in a way I'd not really been as close to before. And off I went.
So when was, can I ask, when was the time when you joined AA and stopped?
That was in the early 80s. I stopped drinking on the 12th of July, 1982.
Gosh.
And I went into AA not long afterwards. I had therapy. The psychiatrist who diagnosed me as an alcoholic put me onto a psychiatrist, and I did some work there. But I needed to be with people of similar mind.
Yes.
I went into AA and a smoky basement of a Baptist church in Westmoreland Terrace in Pimlico, and went three times a week early in the morning, and then bit by bit I stepped up the number of meetings I was doing.
And that set you up.
That changed my life. It gave me a power and a strength and a spirit that was quite new. And I've stuck with AA right way through.
And the 12-step program, I mean, is something that was created by the founders of AA, I think. And it basically, it's you know, like there's NA, Alcoholics Anonymous, there's all sorts of them.
There's 26 different, at least 26 different 12-step programs in the UK, even more in America. In fact, you can, any problem you've got, you can apply a 12-step approach to it and try to resolve it. It's my view. So I've done some work on this within Parliament. We've created a group of cross-party parliamentarians who have an interest in recovery from addiction. And we have an all-party parliamentary group on the 12 steps, which is doing extraordinarily well.
Wonderful. Well, I think I mentioned to you before we recorded this, that I had an actress friend of mine, quite well known, who got this part at the Theatre Royal Manchester or something, playing an alcoholic. And she said to me, "Oh, God, I don't know what to do. I'm not an alcoholic." And I said, "Oh, well, I know people who are." I took her to a meeting and she was so knocked out with it. And, you know, she said, "God, everybody needs this 12-step stuff." And I think that's a very interesting thought.
Well, I had a similar experience with one of my peer colleagues who was an exceptionally talented scientist and economist. I took him to an AA meeting. He couldn't believe what it was like. And he was a man who was involved in creating, with Tony Blair and the Labour government, talking therapy.
All right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, we'll move on in a minute, but I mean, is it not that it's sort of founded on sort of principles, you know, expounded by Carl Jung, sort of Christianity, common sense, basic psychology, isn't it? I mean, tell me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right. It's got all the elements of history from a biblical point of view, but it's also got psychology in there, and it's got a very clear step-by-step method of enabling someone to accept they have a problem, seek ways, and recognizing they're not the center of the universe any longer, which is what I thought I was, but there was some power greater than me, and I needed to have a look at what I'd done wrong, and to seek to put it right, and to make amends to the people I'd harmed. And to work with others and to help others, which is then the fundamentals for spiritual awakening.
Yes. So it is all to do. I mean, a lot to do with sort of clearing up perhaps what happened in your childhood or what triggers it all.
I mean, benefit I got, if I got nothing else out of AA, I had a reconciliation with my father towards the end of his life.
Ah, interesting.
Yes, we learned to love each other, having had years of enmity. And that came directly out of working the steps, step four, when I had to have a look at my resentments towards my father, and then see if there'd been any parts in me which had created resentments and the disharmony. And of course there were. And I saw him in a quite different light to what I'd done previously.
Gosh,
we made up, yeah.
That's really something. And what about your brothers?
And my brothers, I had a good relationship with them, but they're all dead now. I'm an orphan.
Oh, Clive, that's a very tragic situation. I'll have to send around some friends immediately.
Abandoned, but I do actually have a lot of company.
Yes.
A great fellowship.
And Lorna, has that sort of kept it together? I mean, do you think if you hadn't gone into AA, 12-step fellowships, etc., that perhaps
the marriage would have gone years ago. And in fact, in days when I was not on the best of forms, you'd say you would need to get to a meeting.
Well, I think that's brilliant. I mean, I'm told that this is probably relevant for anyone listening who's at the beginning of this sort of journey, as they say, that the issue with being an addict is that it's rather, there is a bit of a jack-in-the-box effect. You can put down one thing.
Oh, yes.
And then, bing! Suddenly,
If you're an addict, you're an addict. And yeah. You think you conquered one. We never quite conquer it, but at least we're managing it better than immediately. I had problems with food all the time, and I had always acting out with sex.
Right, right.
A lifetime of it.
Right.
And I've done 12-step programs on those topics as well, but probably I was addicted to work. And again, success to a degree, to the extent I've had success, has come from my willingness to work hard. But and I think that goes back to an addiction to work.
But I wonder whether I could put that idea to you that, a lot of that is to do with self-esteem, that if we work like maniacs, what we're really doing is actually trying to boost our self-esteem, feel great about ourselves because we've achieved that.
I think to an extent, but if you do if you practice the program which I'm practicing, there is a stage beyond that, and because I reached the point where I will no longer be in Parliament or in public life, I will still, I think, be on a journey and still learning.
Yes. Oh, yes. I didn't mean it like that. Yeah. I just meant that I think because of a separate thing that I do with mental health talks, etc. Self-esteem seems to be such an important area of a lot of mental problems.
Yes, and we get our recognition often with the work we do. Yes, our perception of others comes from our efforts at work. But I increasingly see it's only part of life.
Yeah. No, I mean, I remember being, T.S. Eliot wrote in a play of his, he said, we like to be thought well of by others in order to think well of ourselves, and we know all that, but it's interesting. Without being too cheesy, that you are one of the most hardworking peers. And I mean, this is just my research, and it's quite interesting that you've made 517 contributions in the chamber, vocal, in its all citations, and submitted 179 written questions to government departments during your time in the Lords. So it's quite a lot, but I found it was one question that you asked that I just suggest. It's interesting that. And you asked Her Majesty's government whether they plan to take further action to encourage NHS users to accept greater responsibility for their health. And I thought that was a very interesting question, bearing in mind what you've done. I mean, you've took responsibility in for your health in terms of the alcoholism department. But I mean, I know you're always involved in whether it's eating disorders, addiction or whatever. But what's your vibe on that, taking responsibility?
That's an interesting one, Jeremy. I can't remember asking that question, but it's at the heart of much of what I try to do. My experience of life was that I had to accept responsibility. And once I did that, my life changed. Once I saw my part in events, rather than blaming other people for things that seemed to go wrong. I've looked after my health because of the program. I had cancer in my mid-50s. I had bowel cancer, as I mentioned.
Yes.
And which is a big overweight. Number. I was overweight, and I kept being told by doctors I needed to get my weight down and reduce the stress. I went to the gym in my 60s, joined a gym in my 60s, and I'd never done any exercising for years.
Right.
And I was doing it twice a week, then stepped it up three times a week because I was enjoying it so much. And I took steps like that. I was overweight still, struggled with sugar. We put one, I as an addict, I'm basically an addict. I mean, I've had the good fortune with my addiction where I can apply that to work, and I became a workaholic to that produced some positive results, some benefits.
Yeah, no, obviously that's great. You know, I presume you could become a gardening addict, and that'd be great for the garden.
Could have ended up, like many people with diabetes, having an amputation in due course. It's frightening the number of people on a daily basis are having limbs taken off because of diabetes.
Goodness.
Type 2. And that can be avoided to a degree if we take steps ourselves. And I took the step of stopping processed sugar in January, and it worked wonders for me. I shed 7 kilos in no time.
But it's just coming back.
It's much better for it.
I mean, I can see that being a patron of SugarWise, which is obviously a sugar. What is that exactly?
Well, it's a small charity that actually encourages people indirectly to consume less sugar. The woman who founded it was amazed to discover when she was buying food for her baby, a new baby, how much sugar was going into her child. And she thought this was not the best thing. And when we look at our lives, we start with milk, which is sweet, but often we're put onto processed food as children, and much of it has sugar. And so fairly early in life, we're starting to be addicted to sugar.
Yes.
Now, the charity seeks to highlight the problems of sugar, but in particular, it seeks to persuade manufacturers and processors to reduce the amount of sugar in the products. And if they do that, they get a seal of OK from the organisation. They've been doing work with school meals, for example, trying to encourage local schools to offer better food. Some of the food is awful, being fed to children.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of us didn't know anything, did we? I mean, you know, have a Coke, have a Fanta, all of that. And also you're going, oh, for goodness sake, what's wrong? Blimey, you know, it's not drugs. I think there is we all need to have a balance in life. We do have some guilty pleasures or whatever it is, you know. Depends on how guilty, I suppose. there's so much more I would like to talk about, but I feel that I feel what we'll do, if I can persuade you to come back and do part two, your story is really, really interesting, because I think a lot of people still believe, you know, that if you say addict or you say alcoholic, this is somebody who's walking around with a bottle of meths in their pocket or you know, some sort of junkie dying on a floor. And of course, those are possibly correct, but they're not really, you know, I think that people don't understand that you can have functioning addicts, as it were, as long as they can function. Clearly with you, well...
And there is a link with mental health too.
Yes, absolutely.
A direct link. I spent a lot of time working on mental health in recent years.
Yeah.
The Royal College of Psychiatrists has very kindly asked me to sponsor. They offer a scholarship each year to a doctor trainee psychiatrist to come into Parliament, spend 12 months in Parliament, learning about how Parliament works.
No, I didn't know that. That's great, because I know that you're quite close, if you don't mind me saying, to Baroness Sheila...
Collins.
Name. Yes.
Yes. That's a good friend to Sheila.
Yeah.
We share a room now.
Right. Well, that's very nice. That's great. But she's a big hitter, isn't she? I mean, she was the president of the Royal College of Psychiatry.
Yeah, that's great work.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, we've got lots more to say, I'm afraid, Clive. I know you want
my message, if you want any message from me, is applicable not just to the drunk growling, as you're saying, on the park bench, but it's to all people who have addictions, of all the many variety of addictions which we have in life, that there are ways in which we can address them if we can take personal responsibility and recognise our part in it. And there is a solution, and there is joy. There is joy in life.
Yes. And really, I could say that you were a fully paid up ambassador to the 12-step program.
Very much indeed.
And that if somebody had got an obsession with gardening, we could bring them in and get them to Gardening Anonymous 12-step program. But well, anyway, we've got to leave it there now, unfortunately. What we will do is come back when you have a moment and we'll do life jackets. Right, Clive, we've got to that very important part of the show now, which is we call this part of the show the life jackets. And these are the things that you, when the chips are down, when, you know, the Thames is overflowing, you're in the life raft with Lorna, and you think, well, we're going to have to put some life jackets on to keep us going, to keep us afloat. So normally what we say is, what's your favourite? What film would you want to take, remember, what novel, what book, what prayer, what pet, what hobby? I mean, there's all sorts of things, as you know, that we've sent you. And I know that you say to me, well, I hardly do any of those things because I'm so busy. But there must, I know we talked about a film.
Well, there are some things that, I mean, if I was in a lifeboat, I would pray.
Well, okay.
I spent quite a bit of my life praying now, meditating. If I was looking for entertainment, because we do need entertainment in life and lightness, I would probably look for some zany films to take with me, like Blazing Saddles.
Didn't you say to me once that you're a bit of a fan of Airplane?
Yes, I like Airplane, craziness.
I think that's
Forrest Gump as well.
Oh, right. But Airplane, I think, is you know, I saw that not so long ago. It is very, very, very funny. And it's completely mad. I mean, the pilot, Leslie Nielsen, and the one where there's the guy who's come on the plane, he's been jilted, you know, by his girlfriend, and he can't stop telling everybody about it. And he sits next to an old lady, and he's going, so then... And in the end, you know, 10 minutes later, she's hung herself, and that's not very PC.
Amazing film.
Tell me about you and dogs.
Well, I had cancer in my mid-50s, and I was in hospital in the Royal Marsden. I was in room and pumping morphine into myself after the operation. And I had a painting on the wall by a woman called Helen Paul. It was a painting of a little French village scene with a stall with vegetables and fruit, and a little dog sat next to the stall. And the dog's head, because of the morphine I was taking, I was out seeing sex. The dog's head was jumping up and down and waving and nodding. And I'd never had a dog, and I thought, if this dog is with me during this hell I'm going through and is keeping me company, I'm going to have a dog when I come out of hospital, which is what I got. I got a Cairn Terrier called Daisy. And we've had Cairn Terriers for over 20 years with no children. We've got Cairn Terriers instead.
And theirs are the children.
Yes, very much so.
And what, the current one?
Current one is Barney. Barney is balmy, people say, but absolutely loved. He was a show dog, successful show dogs. The showers, when they stop winning, they get rid of them, they offload them.
Right.
And so he came to us as a rescue dog after we'd lost the previous one, had the previous one put down. He's about 10. Wonderful dog. Everybody knows him, loves him.
Oh, brilliant.
I'd have him in the boat with us.
Oh, good. No, that's great. Okay, so we've got that. Now, you may have to take some plants with you. I mean, are you a gardener?
Do a little bit. We've got a terrace here, and we've got a garden around us where we live in Battersea, overlooking the River Thames. And I'm surrounded by a particular shrub that I'm attached to, Cotinus grace. I've got one on the terrace, and I've got one at the front of the house, one at the front of the flat, one at the side, and I give them away as gifts to people who are particularly close to me.
Oh, great. Oh,
they
that's
are,
good.
And it's an extraordinary plant. Its leaves change colour, and they are wonderful in the autumn, deep red and golden colours with veins in them. I love them. So,
So basically a window box could come in the boat.
Just about. It needs to grow a little bit more than a window box.
Yeah, okay, okay. One of the things I think we may have omitted to tell you, but don't worry about it, is that we normally ask everybody who comes on the show. My grandfather was a very well-known gardener, and his was as well, from Anglesey. And we have this book, which is here. And
yes,
my grandfather wrote this book, and it's a very racy title, considering it was written in 1940 or something. And we just ask each guest to read a couple of pages. So I hope we could contact you later, and we should have asked you at the beginning.
Yeah, I'll certainly do that.
Oh, well, that's great.
That's a lovely title as well.
Making Love to Mother Earth, very naughty. And so, you know, that's great. So, okay, look, we'll just finish on this. Couple of things. We're in the boat, and do you have something that you do, you know, with stress, you know, and, oh my God, stress, you do that sort of deals with it? I mean, maybe it's walking the dog. I don't know. Some people do the washing up, they empty the dishwasher, they do something manual. I mean, what about you?
Well, I think mainly, I mentioned it earlier, meditating and mindfulness. I was doing mindfulness yesterday evening with a crowd of people. In the
really?
On my knees.
Right.
That's what cools me down and gives me a better perspective of life and gives me the spirit and the power to get up and go. And then next is walking the dog and seeing the beauty of God's creation around me.
Great. Oh, that's lovely. That's lovely.
Back to your grandfather.
Yes. No. Well, he was quite interesting, actually. Well, there were a million things we could have talked about, but we've talked about the really important ones, I think. So these are the last two, honestly, the last two things I'm going to say. I just want you to comment on this. A Scottish doctor called Dr. Ronnie McTavish in 1885 was asked, what do you need to be happy? And Dr. McTavish said, you need three things. One, you need something to do. Two, you need something or someone to love. And three, you need something to hope for. What do you feel about that?
Oh, I've got no problem with those at all. I mean, the fundamental is that ultimately we end on our own. And we're either comfortable on our own or we're not. And if I'm comfortable on my own, that invariably means I'm with my maker. I am expressing gratitude for what I've had, looking to the future with hope. And I should, but don't do it very much. I should be praising the glory of God. But that may be something for me to do more later in life.
Yeah, when you're a bit older.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Final question now. So I pretty well know the answer to this, but let's just say, you know, somebody who's 17, 18 turns up on knocking on the house of the Lord's door, wanting to talk to Lord Brooke, is in a bit of a 2 and 8, not knowing what to do with her life and got this problem and that problem, you know, psychological. Or what do you think? If it was like you age that, you know, age 16, 17, what would you say now to that person?
I think the older I've got, the one thing that I've learned is that the less I have, the more I have, which is quite contrary to all that we're taught, which is that we need more and more. And that is an amazing revelation which has come to me, that in each decade I've let something go. And as I've let that go, I've become happier. I needed to drink less, because as we talked about it, but I needed to eat less. I think I probably need to travel less. And I think if I can come closer to my home community, life gets better, to a group, to an individual. I would say to the 17-year-old, work hard. It is satisfying.
Mm.
Look after your health. but in particular, try to work with others and help others, and you'll find you get amazing dividends coming back way beyond what you'd ever expected.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I think that's really great. What can I say? Thank you so much, Clive. That's really been a wonderful show, and I hope we'll have you back when you're 90 or 100. I don't mind. I'll do a deal with you. You get extra bonus.
We'll go for 90 for the time being.
Okay. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. Really great. And here we are back in episode 13, and it's a retrospective because I'm so pleased to say that we have reunited with the one and only Karen Cowan. And it's a great thing because she's been very ill and now she's much better. Welcome, Karen.
Hi. I'm sorry I've been away and I've missed everybody, and great to be back.
Great, and you're feeling okay now.
I'm feeling okay now, but it took me 6 weeks to get over COVID. So
it's quite a big deal, isn't it? And can be, obviously was.
Yeah, I think it can be if you have underlying issues, but it's gone now, thank God.
Great,
that's really good.
Okay, well that's really good. Well, here we are, episode 13. Lord Clive Brook, you know, I still think, you know, we put it out sadly without you, but we're now going to complete what you think. And I still think it's a remarkable episode. I can't quite believe that he is 80 years old, a longtime member of the House of Lords, and has that degree of, he's so articulate and so, so together. What did you think of the whole thing?
Well, I thought it was marvellous, and I think the biggest thing I noticed about Lord Clive is the peace he's come to. He sounds a very peaceful person. He's come to set terms with himself and his place in the world and his place alongside others. And I think he's got to a great place for his age. And
yeah, I think.
Listening to him, yes.
Yeah, you're right, actually. I haven't said that. I think it's a really good point. And I think what was great about him, or is great about him, is he, you know, he's got this ability to laugh about himself and the situations. Clearly, you know, what I thought was extraordinary was how he talked about his childhood and being one of, you know, four brothers. And I thought, oh, that's obviously what's caused everything in his life. But it didn't seem to. It was much more to do with his father and his father, you know, wanting a girl and all that. Now, how did you read all that?
Well, the funny thing was, it was rather difficult to read. And I'd like to have talked to him more about that. But clearly, the fact that his father was so very keen on having a girl would have had quite an impact on him, as well as his closeness to his mother, you know, when he was sleeping in bed with his mum while his dad was away at war. And also the fact that his mother vocalised that he was the favourite. So I'm pretty clear that the being the favourite and the impact on the other boys and his father, and the fact that his father was so keen on having a girl, are likely to have impacted him, and I'd like to know more about it. But what I thought was really interesting and quite funny in a way was that when you asked him what kind of a childhood he had, he said, yeah, and what were the problems? And he used the word, the problems were nicely hidden.
Oh, yeah.
Which was quite interesting. And so it was difficult to make sense of it in such a short space of time. But clearly, in a way, it seems like the wanting him to be a girl has kind of been helpful to him in a way as well, because he seems to have been able to, in the old-fashioned way, get in touch with his feminine side,
which has
obviously helped him greatly in his life.
Yes, well, of course, that's all, you know, quite interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, now that's all very, very groovy indeed. Now, whether that was so groovy in the 1960s or 70s, I don't know. But one thing he referred to a lot was wanting to be looked at and attention seeking. What do you think on that?
I think everybody wants to be looked at and attention seeking when they're little, don't they? And I think perhaps, again, it was difficult to completely make sense of that, except that he has gone on to sort of draw attention to himself in a very good way later on. And I wonder if, because his father was away when, you know, at war when he was a very small child, perhaps he wanted to be looked at by his father, sort of thing. And, you know, and because of being the younger brother, he needed to find a way to be looked at and to get attention. And I think also the fact that he was so successful at junior school and not so successful at later school, that will have impacted on his need. Well, if I'm not successful at school, I might as well be looked at and be fun and be interesting and sort of be bad.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Well, I mean, just in this sort of linear way, what was extraordinary to me was he went into the trade union movement and just accelerated into it and did terribly well very quickly, as it were, into 20s and teens, 20s and 30s, which is all, you know, all great. And then met his wife, Lorna, I mean, which is, again, amazing. Married 55 years, amazing. But that's when all the drinking really took off. And again, you know, and I'm not trying to lead this down away. I'm just saying it's because what he himself said. And all the acting out followed on from that.
Yes, I think it almost sounds as if part of the drinking was serendipity because of the world of the unions, you know, heavy drinking unions in the 60s and so on, and the acting out and everything. You know, part of the drinking may have been about the confusion about, you know, is it better to be a girl or a boy in my father's eyes? And he mentioned that he had affairs with both genders, and obviously, you know, lots of people do that, but maybe that was also about some confusion about his sexuality and so on, and maybe that did play into the drinking. I quite honestly, I'd like to talk to him more, but I think that and working so very, very hard within such a hard drinking culture as well.
Yeah, and being successful.
Yeah.
I mean, I, you know, again, I'm repeating myself, but I think that what's extraordinary is to listen to somebody who is at a, you know, late-ish stage in life, 80, and he's sort of so reconciled with so much of that. And I think that must be, it really must, one has to give a lot of credit here to the, you know, the 12-step groups that he's been involved in and AA and everything. Don't you? I mean,
yeah. Oh yes. I mean, he really is a wonderful advertisement for the 12-step programs, and I found it quite interesting because I didn't know quite so much about how many different types of 12-step programs that there are, which it is very interesting and helpful. And clearly, you know, the 12-step program helped him enormously in terms of kind of joining a group of sort of people. And he did some wonderful things through it. I mean, making up with his father will have led to him, you know, giving this aura of peacefulness, you know, because obviously falling out with people is not a good thing for oneself psychologically. And he really does credit the 12-step program with everything, doesn't he? It's very good that he's able to credit them with that. And I think that's also a sign of kind of coming to terms with life and being so peaceful that you are able to credit something else with that so much of what is good in your life. And that something else was one of the something else was the 12-step program.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, what I liked about listening to Lord Clive is that, you know, he's done a lot. You know, he was on the executive council of the TEC. That's quite a big deal in life. And to be a member of the House of Lords and to have done what he's done is a big deal. But he has this sort of acceptance, I suppose, about himself. You know, this is me. It doesn't, you know, how everyone does it these days, don't they? They go, well, actually, I'm a bit of a Quaker. Sorry about that, you know, but, you know, everyone apologizes for what they are. And he doesn't. And I thought, you know, when we talked about having the life jackets and lifeboats and all that, and he said, well, you know, the thing I would be doing in that lifeboat is praying. And I thought, yeah. Great. I mean, I'm just saying that it was very unapologetic, but I think you mentioned earlier that he's not somebody who beat a drum either.
No, I think he was, is, you know, very, very unapologetic, but he hasn't got anything to apologise about. But certainly because he's, you know, from what it sounds like, he's kind of made amends with anyone he felt he did, or anything he felt he did have to come to terms with. But you started by talking about the prayer and everything. And I think, you know, he mentioned mindfulness and meditation, and clearly that's been incredibly helpful to him. And that reminded me how much, you know, it's worth thinking about for your listeners, you know, about how helpful mindfulness is. Even 15 minutes of mindfulness in the morning or meditation really, really sets you up and kind of makes you be present and non-judgmental of yourself, not makes you, but helps you, and so on. So, you know, and I think at the end, he also said about some of the things he would perhaps advise people now he's come to quite an old age, you know, about what's important in life.
Well, one of the things he said, which was very, I thought, very touching, was he said that what he's discovered is that he wants, you know, less is more. He wants fewer things in his life. And that's given him more happiness, I think. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yes, I do remember it very well. And of course, he's so right, as we know, because the more things you have, the more complicated your life is, and kind of why bother with it? And he's come to that, you know, as the years have gone on, he's come to that the simpler you can keep your life, quite often the kind of better it is. I thought it was very interesting when he mentioned about, you know, traveling less and coming back to his own community and kind of embedding yourself in your community and helping the community and being helped by the community. That's not exactly what he said, but that was what is implicit.
No, I get it. Yeah, I get it.
That's incredibly important too, that right on your doorstep is a wonderful world of the people and the place around you.
Yes, and the great thing is that just stepping back from this for a second, to be able to look at your whole life, an 80-year-old life, and talk about being a little boy who's being a ballet dancer in front of his father and knowing it would, you know, wind him up, whatever. The thing that I took away from a lot of this was that there was no recrimination on himself. You know, it was like, well, those things have happened. Thank you very much. I mean, I remember when I asked him to do it, when I said, oh, you know, it could be very embarrassing, it could be this, but don't worry. He said, I don't care anyway. He said, I don't care what anybody thinks. But not in a nasty way, just that I'm quite happy, thanks. That's quite interesting.
Absolutely wonderful. And he focused on honesty as well. And I think, and that's one of my absolute pet things, my personal pet things, is that if you are honest, you have nothing to be ashamed of, you know, because as soon as you start being dishonest, then it kind of wobbles you because I've got something to be dishonest about. But actually, if you're open about absolutely everything, it helps not only yourself, but other people.
Yeah.
And you don't worry about what people think because they know everything.
Yes, yes. Well, that's excellent. Well, I think we'll end here and just say, you know, he's the patron of sugar-wise, trying to stop us, you know, the old sugar addiction. I think it's probably a very good thing. I don't know whether you've got anything you'd like Lord Clive to be patron of, Karen, but now's the time to speak up. It might be, you know.
Well, he doesn't think he's old, but I think I think it would be the patron saint of honesty and peace.
Okay. And usefulness.
And also, he one of the things that I wanted to mention was that he talked about work. And I think a lucky thing that happened to him, but maybe it was his character as well, was that he so enjoyed his work.
Mm.
He perhaps overworked, which was probably another reason why he drank so much. Because he, in the end, he said, you know, one of the advices was work hard. And that's a wonderful piece of advice if you can work hard and if you're lucky enough to have a job that makes it easy to work hard.
Yes, well, that was a very interesting point, well remembered, that, you know, that was his thing at the end. He said, look, work hard, it gives a lot of rewards. And that was quite unusual, I think, to have said that. And I like that. I mean, he also talked a lot, obviously, about addiction and being addicted to food, sex, booze, drugs, and how, you know, really reaffirming the problem with addiction when you are an addict is that it's like dealing with a jack in a box. You know, you push one thing down and another thing springs up. Was that interesting for you to hear all that? I mean, I think it's pretty good, but what did you think?
I think that's interesting. I know that, you know, that there's a kind of thing about having an addictive personality. I'm not 100% sure about it, but if he thinks that about himself, that, you know, that's his truth, that one of his addictions was work, as well as all the other addictions he says he has, which was sex, alcohol, and some drugs and so on.
Food, yeah.
And food, yeah.
Yeah.
But he also had discipline. He was able to kind of, in the end, put the lid on all the addictions, wasn't he? But it sounds like he thinks he replaced the addictions with work. But I'd like to ask him about that.
Well, I think what he replaced them with was with AA 12-step fellowships. And that's what happened there, I think. Yes. And it's a good point again, you know, that the work ethic with him is pretty important without it being attached to some sort of greed. I think he just likes working. And always has done, and because he works a lot in the Lords, you know, I know how many, you know, I researched it, how many questions he asks, what he does, getting involved in this, that, and the other. So he doesn't stop.
No, but of course, his work is largely about helping other people, and of course, that is enormous in one way or another.
Yeah,
enormously satisfying kind of work, isn't it? That his work has managed to achieve so much for other people.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So there's lots of, as I say, lots of takeaways from hearing that. But it's good to have you come back and comment on all that because there's some very interesting things that you noticed that I didn't. Anyway, I think that's it. Any more comments? Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I just think we'd be very lucky if we'd got to the spiritual and psychological stage that Lord Clive has got to, the stage of peace that Lord Clive has got to at the age of 80.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, we want whatever he's taking.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, take a few leaves out of his book. Yes.
Okay. Brilliant. Fantastic. Really grateful for that. That's it for this episode, episode 13. We're going to roll the credits in a minute, but we want to say thank you very much to a really completely replenished and gorgeous Karen Cowan, as ever. Thank you. So it's time for the credits, and basically we want to say a big thank you to our editor of all of the episodes of Shed Talks up until number 12, and that is, thank you, Stuart Bagshaw, who's been kidnapped by a film company and taken away from us. But welcome to our new editor, Lukey Tupman, Great to have you on board, Luke. That's very great. Thank you very much, Bryony, for all your efforts so far, and hopefully you'll still be with us in the future, and everybody else who has contributed to make Shed Talks what it is today. Thank you so much, and Happy New Year. Be groovy, and onwards and upwards, tip top and tidy.